Welcome to SCOTUScast, Healthcare and State Immunity Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 30, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Coleman v. Maryland Court of Appeals. The question here was whether Congress, in passing the self-care provision of the Family and Medical Leave Act, validly abrogated the sovereign immunity of states. Under the self-care provision, a state worker may sue if the state interferes with the worker's statutory rights to a certain amount of leave due to a personal debilitating health condition. Here, the lower court had dismissed such a lawsuit. By a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the lower courts, but did so without a majority opinion. Justice Kennedy, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Alito and Thomas, filed a plurality opinion concluding that sovereign immunity barred the state worker's suit. Justice Thomas also filed a separate concurring opinion. Justice Scalia filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, but relying upon a different rationale than the plurality. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Breyer joined, and in which Justices Sotomayor and Kagan joined, as to all except footnote 1. To discuss the case, we have Elizabeth Price Foley, who is a professor at the Florida International University College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Foley.
This case was a civil lawsuit seeking monetary damages under the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, or the FMLA. And it was filed by Daniel Coleman against his employer, the Maryland Court of Appeals. And Mr. Coleman alleged that the court fired him because he had requested sick leave under the FMLA. Now, the FMLA allows up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave for four different types of situations. Number one, the birth of a child. Number two, the adoption of a child. Number three, caring for a sick family member, or the family leave provisions. And then finally, the fourth one is caring for yourself when you're sick. This is the so-called self-leave provision of the FMLA. And Mr. Coleman's leave request involved this last provision, the self-leave provision. So when Mr. Coleman filed his lawsuit, the Maryland Court of Appeals defended the lawsuit by asserting sovereign immunity, which is grounded in the 11th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Mr. Coleman responded that the sovereign immunity defense that was being asserted was, in fact, inappropriate because Congress, in enacting the self-leave provision, had been exercising its enforcement power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. You may recall that Section 5 of the 14th Amendment says that Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of the 14th Amendment. And as such, Mr. Coleman asserted that the self-care provision of the FMLA was a valid abrogation of state sovereign immunity. So this was the question presented to the Supreme Court. Is the self-care provision of the FMLA an attempt by Congress to remedy documented gender discrimination in the workplace? And if it was a documented remedy for gender discrimination in the workplace, it would be a valid exercise of Congress's enforcement power under Section 5, and state sovereign immunity would fall or be abrogated. Now, I know that in the introduction to this podcast, you learned that the court decided by a 5-4 vote that sovereign immunity barred Mr. Coleman's lawsuit. So a majority of the court did not believe that the self-care provision was an attempt to remedy documented gender discrimination. But this decision is actually more accurately described as a sort of 4-1-4 decision, because Justice Scalia is the one that I'm talking about. He concurs in the judgment here that sovereign immunity will bar this lawsuit by Mr. Coleman, but he doesn't agree with the reasoning of the plurality opinion that was penned by Justice Kennedy. But still, there were 5 votes for the conclusion that sovereign immunity bars Mr. Coleman's lawsuit. So let's take Justice Kennedy's plurality opinion first. As the introduction told you, Justice Kennedy was joined by Justices Alito, Thomas, and then Chief Justice Roberts. So this was sort of the more conservative wing of the court, if you will. The plurality here, led by Justice Kennedy, acknowledged that back in 2003, the Supreme Court had decided a case called Nevada Department of Human Resources versus Hibbs. And in Hibbs, the Supreme Court had ruled that sovereign immunity actually did not bar a monetary damage suit against the states accused of violating the family leave provisions of the FMLA. Now, family leave, in other words, a family leave provision was a valid exercise of the Section 5 enforcement power. And the reason the Hibbs majority thought that was because they thought that Congress had built a rather extensive record that there was gender discrimination against women in the family leave policies offered by employers. In other words, if you look at the legislative history associated with the family leave provision of the FMLA, what Hibbs found was that there was plenty of evidence that women were viewed by employers as principal caregivers when family members like kids or parents or even your own spouse got sick. So the family leave provisions were designed to prevent this kind of gender discrimination in violation of the 14th Amendment, so the state's sovereign immunity had to fall. But the Coleman plurality in this case didn't buy this gender discrimination argument with regard to the self-care part of the FMLA. They looked at the legislative history of the self-care provision, and they saw what the plurality called, quote-unquote, scant evidence of congressional intent to help protect women from discrimination. In fact, the plurality saw in the record evidence of congressional intent to help both men and women obtain sick leave. In other words, what they saw was a desire by Congress to help all workers by allowing them to take unpaid leave and keep their jobs after they had a temporary illness or a disability. So the plurality acknowledged that when you looked at the legislative history of the self-care provisions, there were what they called a few fleeting references to gender discrimination concerns by Congress. But the plurality concluded that these were what they called supposition and conjecture, and that the gender discrimination motivations were not backed up by actual evidence of gender discrimination in self-care provisions. So the bottom line with regard to the plurality, I think, is that they concluded their opinion by saying, and I'll quote here, "Congress must rely on more than abstract generalities to subject the states to suits for damages." And that kind of evidence just wasn't present with the self-care provision. Now, I said earlier that it's probably a case that's best characterized as a 4-1-4 decision and that Justice Scalia was the one. So let me just talk for a minute about why Justice Scalia decided to concur in the judgment and not in the opinion of the plurality. He said that the reason he was doing that was because he wanted to express his belief that the court's abrogation jurisprudence, in his words, made no sense. Justice Scalia said that this abrogation jurisprudence was arbitrary because he thought that it required the court to sort of cull the legislative history of a federal law to figure out whether there was, you know, enough evidence that Congress was trying to remedy a perceived violation of the 14th Amendment. Now, instead of that kind of culling of the legislative history, Justice Scalia's approach would be to sort of jettison all of that case law entirely and do something somewhat interesting. He said that Congress's power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment was to enforce actual violations of the 14th Amendment. And he said that outside the context of race discrimination, so he put race discrimination claims aside because he said for reasons of stare decisis. He said outside the context of race discrimination, he didn't believe Congress could use Section 5 to enact what's commonly referred to as prophylactic legislation. In other words, legislation that was designed to prevent or deter unconstitutional conduct. And specifically, Justice Scalia said, only when the conduct itself actually violates the 14th Amendment could Congress use its Section 5 of the 14th Amendment enforcement power. And Justice Scalia concluded then that failing to grant state employees leave for the purpose of self-care and then he said, or any other purpose for that matter, does not even come close to being a 14th Amendment violation. And therefore, in Scalia's view, the state sovereign immunity doctrine under the 11th Amendment barred Mr. Coleman's lawsuit. And finally, let's spend a couple minutes on the dissenters. We had four dissenters in this case, led by Justice Ginsburg. She was joined by Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. So this is sort of the, if you will, the more liberal wing of the court. Now, these four dissenters believed that the self-care provision of the FMLA was, in fact, a proper remedy for gender discrimination. And they looked at the legislative history of the FMLA and saw it quite differently from the plurality. What they saw in the record was Congress's intent in the FMLA as a whole to prevent gender discrimination against women, particularly pregnant women. And the dissenters thought that Congress was concerned in particular that the family leave provisions of the FMLA and the provision of the FMLA that allows you to take a leave for birth or adoption of a child, that those things together would make employers sort of hesitate to hire women because of the perception and the fact, actually, that women would disproportionately use the family leave provisions and the birth adoption leave provisions. So by enacting this gender-neutral self-leave provision, the dissenters thought that Congress was trying to sort of level the playing field somewhat between men and women. In other words, the dissenters believed that the family leave and the self-leave provisions were inseparable, that you couldn't sort of have one without the other. So when the dissenters looked at the legislative history of the FMLA as a whole, in toto, and not just the self-leave provisions in isolation, what they saw was an adequate record of Congress's intent to remedy gender discrimination. And as such, it was a valid abrogation of sovereign immunity pursuant to Congress's Section 5 enforcement power. In conclusion, I'll just say a couple of sort of large conclusions that I arrived at from reading this decision carefully. I think the case is another example of a very deeply divided court, and the divisions are likely to play out in other areas. We sort of have a more conservative wing of the court that seems to be quite interested in attempting to rein in federal power and the growth of federal power. And we have a sort of more liberal wing that is interested in trying to find ways to allow expansion of federal power where they think it's appropriate. So undoubtedly, this sort of tension in the court is going to play out in future cases and certainly well beyond the sovereign immunity context. So stay tuned and we'll find out how that happens.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.